This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rossland, today we have the person who knows more about modern technology than just about anybody I know.
And I'm glad you qualified.
Well, it's very wrong to say in the whole wide world. And he is famous for that on BFM, Matt Armitage.
Hi, Cam. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have the return of CEO, CFO of Fusaka Industries, the leading protector of cultural heritage in Malaysia.
What's the, my goodness.
Conservation. Pauline Phan.
Hello.
Great to have you back. Did I say that right? CFO, isn't it?
No, actually, it's creative director. But never mind. You can call me whatever you want, Kat.
And our three topics this week will be, topic number one is how technology is changing our bodies. Topic number two is our 15 minutes of fame are up. And finally, topic number three is Kuda Kepang and cultural transformations. So, Matt, modern technology changing our bodies.
Yes, it is. No, one of the things that we often talk about when we talk about technology is the social changes that happen. So we talk about things like there have been various studies recently into depression associated with the isolation to do with technology and social media. So we talk about a lot of these isolating effects. We talk about the changes to people's behavior. One of the effects that digital technology has had especially is that it enables people to shut themselves off from a lot of our social behavior norms. So if you're wearing headphones, for example, which a lot of the people in this studio are doing, it gives you an excuse to have a different set of behaviors. If you make eye contact with someone, for example, you can break that eye contact with someone without acknowledging that person's existence. You can, if you meet somebody on a street, let's say you're looking for directions, you can if you've got headphones in, you can ignore that person talking to you, whereas it would be rude for somebody else to. So we have all of these behavioral changes that are associated to technology, but we don't talk so much about a lot of the physical changes that are occurring, or rather we've talked about them in some terms, like we've talked about text thumb. For example, we talk about repetitive strain injuries that you either get in your shoulders or your arms as a result of typing. But these are not necessarily new conditions. People have always had these kind of stress-related conditions to do with the kind of work that they're doing. But when we talk about the changes that technology is making to us, we usually talk about external changes. So one of the stories that came out this week is the Neuralink that Elon Musk is proposing. And that's a chip that can be implanted into the brain. Mm. And it can connect via Bluetooth, of all ridiculous things, to your smartphone. So you can actually control information. You can control a computer just using your brain.
What? Yeah, that's going to end well,
that
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is one of the things, you see. So it's not so much having the chip in your brain that's the problem. It's actually all the protections that go with that chip. So there are issues of ownership, for example. So, for example, when we own a smartphone, we own the phone, but we don't own the operating system. What happens when somebody puts that chip into your brain? Mm. Do they own the operating system? Do they have partial ownership of your memories, your thoughts? These are all of the things that we kind of think about when we talk about technology shaping our bodies. In the same way, there are external systems like ReWalk, which are essentially a musculoskeletal system, a robot that you can wear that is for paraplegics, quadriplegics. It can help them to walk. Now, those systems are already on sale.
But that also then has to be linked to your central nervous system, doesn't it?
No, that one operates a little bit more generally. So it's usually people will have some sense of movement. So it can either be controlled by the mouth, or it can be controlled by hand gestures,
depending on what kind of
physical control. So those are a little more basic in that sense. And those systems cost, I think, around $30,000 to $40,000 and are now available in some countries on national, on health services or by insurance providers.
But how does that blue chip work? You mean if you just think something, then you can direct? Yeah.
No, well, all of the big tech...
You've got to be smart in advance. You like the idea.
All of the big technology companies are working on brain interface technology at the moment. So Facebook is working on a system that would allow you to think your Facebook posts.
You're joking.
But a lot of these are non-invasive. So it would be like wearing one of those EEG brainwave monitors. So you put it on and it interprets the data and it posts for you. This is going a stage further. It's putting the chips in your brain, so it's actually integrating your thoughts. The kind of first level of it is actually for people with diseases like motor neurone disease, people with Parkinson's, people who have oh no, I've forgotten the name of the disease that makes you forget everything when you get old.
Oh, I don't know, man.
Alzheimer's. Oh my gosh. No, but it's also to help people with Alzheimer's because it can be used as a way to remind them or to write memories to different
areas. But that means that
the
technology itself is intuitive somehow.
Yes, because it's linked to the cloud and it's linked to artificial intelligence. So you actually have... in the future, the possibility that your brain might contain two individuals. So if we get to a point in the future where artificial intelligence is itself sentient, and you have an AI chip in your brain, you then have to start making determinations over whether you're one individual or two individuals.
Oh, good Lord.
And also which individual actually has dominion over your body.
Because one of them, the AI, would know what's good for you.
Exactly.
You'd be programmed. Yeah. You know, so you're not going to have more cream.
Yes, exactly. You'd be fighting yourself with that French frying in your hand.
Yeah. But you're talking about giving physicality back to people who have lost it.
Yes, but there is another stage, which is not something that has been looked at quite so deeply, which is actually two stages. One is changes to our bodies as a result of the way that we're using technology, but also evolutionary jumps that we may see our bodies making as a result of the way that we live. So in terms of the changes to our skeletons now, researchers have started to see bone spurs forming at the base of the skull and the neck. Yeah. Now, these aren't dangerous, but they are visible. So they're visible like little horns at the back. And it's as many as one in four people, I think, under the age of 25 may have these spurs to some degree.
Is it because mod music's not very good and it's a reaction to...
Yeah, exactly. It's because they're banging their heads so hard. No, it's simply because of the way that we're hunched over looking at screens and devices. Of course, your head weighs around like three, four kilos, I think. So the weight of that on the base of your spine, that's a lot of pressure to bear. So over time... that's starting to cause these little bone growths, which are actually helping to support the head.
Oh my God, I am really rubbing the back of my head.
I know. So
yeah, everyone kind of searches for that. I mean, as long as they're not growing out of the front of your head and you've got the mark of the beast on you, you should be pretty much
evolutionary inherited traits. Where are you going with this, Matt?
Well, the evolutionary, because... when we first became hunter-gatherers, we changed the way we process food, the way we stand, the way we move changed. Mm-hmm. We were very much like the higher apes at that point. We were very sedentary. We slept for large portions of the day. But over time, our bodies have changed and adapted so that we could walk for 12, 14, 16 hours a day as we hunted for food. And those are the bodies that we have now. But those aren't the lifestyles that we have now. And of course, evolution in humans is a very, very slow process, whereas the adoption of technology is very fast, but the way our bodies adapt to it is very, very slow. So what we're also starting to see is changes in the skeleton. So I think a French researcher found that the elbows of younger people are now smaller than they would be in previous generations.
Paul and I rubbing our elbows too. I don't know what
that is. And that's partly because we're not doing the same amount of carrying and lifting. Yeah. We're not as physical. Mm. So it's that reinforcement of the physicality that causes the bone to grow and to remain stable.
Well, thank you for that, Matt. Once again. Matt always comes on and he comes and frightens me.
Definitely frightens.
Yeah.
I don't find that frightening. I find that really interesting. I'd quite like to be a quivering lump of jelly sitting on a table top.
Speak for yourself. Yeah.
Well, I think that leads us neatly onto my topic, topic number two, which I've labeled your 15 minutes of fame are up. Somebody wrote something on Twitter, which it really spoke to me, and I don't quite know why, but it really made sense. I don't know who it was. It's not a Malaysian. I can't remember who it was now. He said that in the future, if not already, we will not be seeking out our 15 minutes of fame, but instead our 15 minutes of anonymity. And it did make me think, because this whole social media thing, I felt a need to retreat for some time. I mean, here I am talking about wanting to retreat on a radio station, a radio show, beaming out to literally pairs of people. And so, you know, the idea of seeking out anonymity may sound ridiculous. But nonetheless, you know, the social media circus, the kind of desire to sell a particular version of oneself, the best possible version. And I was driving past KLCC the other day, and there were some tourists, and I think there were two young girls from China, I think. And one of the girls was doing that right now rather classic pose. I see if I can describe it on the radio, where she was like ahead of the photographer, as if leading the photographer by the hand. Mm-hmm. Right. And it could suggest that the photographer was the boyfriend, but it wasn't. It was just her friend. And I was thinking, that's a very cliche. When I first saw it, I thought it was a very kind of beautiful image. But now it's a very hackneyed image. And it suggests a life and a lifestyle and a personality that you may not have, but it's certainly the one you'd wish to advertise to the world. And I'm adventurous and you can't stop me. I will take you places, not the other way around. And how long can one sustain that fiction? So I'm not saying that I necessarily would be wanting to go and be a Unabomber and go and live up on a mountain and write a manifesto and go blow things up. But nonetheless, I wonder, and I'd like to ask you, Matt, actually first, because of the work that you do, you work a lot with social media, but also with users who are our age, but younger again. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, uptake on Facebook, for instance, is dropping pretty much like a stone.
Yeah.
What are you seeing in the future for young people? Well, how are they reacting?
I mean, you're seeing a very different set of behaviors, I think, from these people. Certainly the younger age groups, you're seeing a much more curated feed. You're not seeing their likes and desires and their personal feelings. They're not doing the kind of venting and expressing that, say, our generation is doing with Twitter or Facebook. That tends to happen much more in kind of lockdown systems. So that's much more in private messaging and private networking groups. Mm. Whereas what you see as the kind of public-facing part of their personality is very heavily curated. Mm. And there's a whole kind of industry that's sprung up around this. I mean, in Russia, for example, there are companies that rent out private jets by the hour.
Oh my goodness.
So that you can go in and have your picture taken with the glass of champagne, right, which I don't think you even get to drink.
Right.
And, you know, so it makes it look as though you have this... you know, see Fortune 500 kind of lifestyle,
oligarch lifestyle.
Yeah. but the plane never leaves the landing strip.
Hilarious.
I mean, even in Malaysia, the kind of mirror beach phenomenon has become very popular. Yeah. So certain beaches in Malaysia that were never visited by anyone have suddenly become these kind of social media phenomena because they have this perfect reflection that everyone wants to achieve
at certain times of the year and certain times of day.
So, yeah. Pauline, I mean, did my little Twitter quote resonate with you? I mean, you are more active, say, on Facebook than I am.
I am, but only I tend never to vent. It's useful for work, and it's useful because I am doing things that I need to reach out to people. So I find it useful for that. And I find it, it's interesting in certain social situations, but I definitely often feel the need to run away and to hide in anonymity, for sure.
But the problem is that we have, we all of us, we three and people out there as well, have already put ourselves out there.
Yeah.
And it's there forever.
It is, but at the same time, I don't think you should feel any obligation to post.
No.
You have the ability to remove your posts, whether that removes it entirely. I mean, people may still have copies of those posts, should you not want them to be seen again, that might be very difficult. But I don't think just because we have done this in the past, we should feel the same obligation going forward. So
no,
the same as Pauline, I mean, so I switch on and off with Twitter quite regularly. I'll go through a period of posting a lot of pictures of my cat on Instagram.
You do. Beautiful. Your cat's very beautiful.
Thank you. And but then I won't post anything else for a couple of weeks. So I've kind of got past that obligation stage, mm-hmm. and I just post things as and when I feel like
I don't have a Twitter or a Instagram. Those are only for Pusaka. So the organization has those. And I only have a Facebook account. I can't deal with the other two.
Too many passwords to remember.
Too
but,
much.
You know, but kids out there. No, I would say, just to wrap up personally, that I hear what you're saying, Matt. And I hear what you're saying, Pauline. You're running away from it. And the temptation for me to do is the same. But at the end of the day, I'm a human, I'm a social being, and I'm not going to do any of those things. I'm complaining about it, and I shall write a post. I'm just being realistic here. That somehow there is, and I agree entirely, and I'm the one who brought it up, but at the same time, there is this kind of light desire. I'm doing it right now on the radio. To stand on top of the mountain and sort of shout out, in the assumption that everyone's hearing it, and say, this is what I believe.
Our millions of listeners. Uh-huh. Yeah,
can I scare you a little bit more?
Oh, God.
The neural network that I was talking about before, the one that Elon Musk is coming up with. Now, the idea of that is you could also communicate pretty much telepathically with other people. So no speech, no writing, just direct user to user. Now, if you extend that analogy a little bit further, you look at sort of 5 or 6 product cycles along from that, you're looking at being able to have multiple conversations because you're talking about things that are happening at synaptic speed, not at the speed with which we process information. So you're basically talking about communication happening between people at effectively the speed of light. So your social media network could be much vaster. And if you feel that the flow of information is drowning you right now, imagine what would be happening if you were getting billions of responses.
Then I'd definitely run away from it.
Yeah, then I would do the Unabomber thing. I would go.
Tinfoil hat.
Yeah. Okay, well, we move on. Thank you again, Matt. We move on.
Frightening stuff, Matt. Yeah.
But in a moment, we're going to go to something completely different here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Matt Armitage, and Pauline Fun. And now, Pauline, Kuda Kepang.
Yes.
And Cultural Transformations.
Yes. So I have been working on a project, a collaborative project, with a group of Kuda Kepang dancers from Parit Raja, Batu Pahat Johor.
Perhaps you could just very quickly tell us.
I will, absolutely. Yeah. So the Kuda Kepang is, it is a tradition that originates in Java, and it's practiced here in Malaysia among Javanese communities. So communities that have come, most of them came, I think, in the 19th century. Many of them settled in Johor, particularly in places like Batu Pahat and Kluang, and places like that. So there's a community on the west coast of Johor that still practices tradition. And it's a tradition that incorporates dance, music, and significantly the element of trance. That's what it's actually famous for. Kuda, of course, is horse in Malay. And Kuda Kepang is referring to the woven horse that they use when they dance. The tradition itself is related to the legend of the Wali Songo, who are the 9 saints of Java. And they were said to have spread the teachings of Islam to the interiors of Java. And they were said to have ridden horses when they did that. And also were very open to incorporating indigenous art forms like wayang kulit and the music of the Kuda Kepang. And so in Java, the experience of the coming of Islam is very much related to their traditional art forms. And there's particularly one of the nine saints, who is Sunan Kalijaga, he is particularly seen as to be the kind of patron of many of these art forms. He's kind of a mystical figure. So the communities in Johor that still do this, in Johor it's a different experience slightly, because they come under some political pressures as well, a cultural politics that's happening all over the country. But there is actually a fatwa in Johor against the Kuda Kepang. It's been there for about 10 years. The communities in Johor, though, they still practice it. They went underground for a while, but they still, because they, it's something that they inherited and it's something that is very much alive. It's not a tradition that they just do either for fun or for entertainment. It's something that is actually very deeply bound with their identities and who they are and their expression. The thing that I love about Kuda Kepang is that it is incredibly intense and provocative and wild. It's actually very wild. So you think of something like traditional art, sometimes we think it's just boring and
state,
something
state troop.
Yeah, kind of, well, that's that is
tourism thing.
Exactly the opposite of what a authentic traditional Kuda Kepang is. The experience of it.
So you're working on a project where it's your art as well.
Yes,
combined with that and photography.
Absolutely. So the Kuda Kepang, I work with a lot of different traditions, but the Kuda Kepang is the one I would say I'm the most obsessed with artistically. And so I started a couple of years ago to kind of respond artistically to it through my writing. So I've started to write sort of fragments, which I'm hoping to one day put into a novella of sorts. But I've started to write kind of prose pieces about the Kuda Kepang, the experience of it, some of the characters who I've encountered. And I've been working closely with a photographer. Her name is Cheryl Hoffman. She is Canadian, but she's been living in Malaysia for a long time, and she works very closely with Pusaka to document. She is also has this kind of obsession with Kuda Kepang, and we've both been responding artistically to this tradition for the last few years. This year, we submitted a collaborative project to the Obscura Festival of Photography, which is taking place in Penang, starting now, and will be the exhibition itself will be up next month. So their theme was subculture for this festival, and we thought Kuda Kepang is the perfect experience of subculture. So we submitted a collaboration of my text and her images, and it got accepted. So it will be shown at the Obscura Festival of Photography. But the interesting thing is the process in which of this collaboration has really made me think about how art forms themselves transform when they encounter each other. The tradition of the Kuda Kepang is an art form in itself. It has, when Cheryl photographs it, it's seen in a completely different way. I mean, it's you experience the intensity through her eyes, and you. I think the performers themselves see themselves in a different light, and I think...
Because the caption is still moments.
It's still moments.
For something that's about movement.
Yeah, it is about movement. And she somehow captures the movement, and she captures also something beyond the image itself. And Kuda Kepang is a lot about that. The project itself, we've called it Alam Taknyata, which is the unseen world. It's what you don't see. A lot of what happens in the Kuda Kepang is something that is happening beyond what you see. And so it's a very physical and it's intense and it's visceral, but the intensity of it, especially during those moments of trance, is what's happening beyond, in the body of the performer, and around the performer and in that ritual space.
So speaking of beyond what you see, then you have your text, your words. How do they merge with the photography and
yeah,
the action?
Exactly. So that itself, that was a process of actually seeing how that would work. So we went through several ideas. The first was that we would actually do it as a print exhibition with my text sort of running through it printed.
Really what I'd do. That's old-fashioned.
Yeah,
old school.
That's old-fashioned. Yeah, yeah. It's old-school, yeah. But then we said, no, this tradition itself is edgy and experimental, and we wanted it, and it's visceral, and we wanted the viewer to actually have a feeling of that, even though they're looking at a different medium and not the performance itself, but we wanted that feeling of this kind of visceral energy to still hold. And so it's not video, but it's a video installation of Cheryl's still images, edited by the brilliant team, Persona Theory, Buddy and Sakina. And they did some marvelous work also with my voice. And so I had to actually, we didn't use my printed words, we used my voice reading my text. And it became, that became a different art form in itself. It's It became a soundscape.
So what you've described is a collaboration.
Yeah,
it's just
very
this,
much.
This is just something which doesn't have the auteur.
Mm-hmm.
And with collaboration comes the bleeding of new ideas.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well,
but Matt, you know of some collaboration.
Yeah, some other collaborations. But also, I'd like to know from Pauline, how did your language change when you changed it from being text on a page to speaking? How did
it changed quite a lot, because I realized that when you speak it, the text, I needed to slow everything down a bit and actually cut out a lot of the text. So passages in the text, in a printed text, I would usually use maybe a page or two pages to capture a moment. Mm. Whereas I think with the sound, you need a lot less.
Mm.
You need a lot less than that. And very often I just cut out whole lines. And so it became even more the fragment was fragmented further, and it became sort of...
About lyrics? Almost like lyrics, was it?
I mean, yeah, like- kind of... because there's no narrative as such. Yeah. It's really kind of impressionistic.
Mm. But did it bring back that sense of motion as well?
It did. Yeah. It did. And breath. And the whole... I mean, I first started to do it on my phone. And of course, we went through many different methods of recording to my phone. And then Cheryl built me a cave in her house. She sealed me up with a mattress. This little thing. And then finally, I went in and did a proper kind of studio recording. But that too, then it was also a matter of responding to her images and finding the right pace and finding the right tone. It's a very interesting process.
So the final presentation will be experienced as people walk in and they see a screen.
Mm-hmm.
They see a
screen. It's going to be on a screen, yes. In a little corner of the Hindbus Depot, which is where the Obscura Festival of Photography is.
But the original performance, though...
Mm-hmm.
It's much bigger than a screen.
Oh, much.
Yeah, and it's much,
much, much bigger.
So you're straight away, you're not able to relay. I don't even know if you're wanting to relay an accurate presentation.
Yeah, well, it's not. It's not a documentary, right? And even the, so this, even Cheryl's response to it is not documentary photography.
Hmm.
It's an artistic, I wouldn't say interpretation, because it is, I think it's actually.
A new thing.
Well, not necessarily. I think it's actually just very much capturing the intensity of the experience. And to me, that is in some ways more reflective of what that entire tradition is about than actually just going in there and doing an anthropological study of it.
Right.
Because what you are left with at the end of a Kudakepa performance is that intensity. And some of those images. I remember the first time I saw a live Kudakepa with the full trance. I mean, I couldn't sleep for days because images come back to you and sounds come back to you and moments.
How long is
In the Kampong, it lasts all night.
Wow.
From about 9 after prayers till 3-4 in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is trippy, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that's intense.
It's all these young boys who come out to release their energy. It's incredible energy.
But girls dance as well, do they not?
Some of them, yes. Not as many. Not many of the girls go into trance.
Right.
And the ones who I've seen go into trance are from a particular family.
Right.
They have a lineage of Kudakepang in their family. But there are girls who dance the Jatilan, which is a related, with this little smaller horse.
Yeah,
that's Javanese. That's very Javanese as well.
Oh. So Matt, would you like to work with, what would you do? What would you do? How would you do it?
How would I do what? Yeah, this you, particular project?
If they then said, and we have another collaborator, Matt Armitage, what would you?
I think I would want to tackle it from the sound perspective as well, actually. I'd want to try and bring it to life in that way. I'm quite into sound art and sound installations, just because of the way that they can play with your senses, especially with the kind of speaker systems that we have now, where you can just beam a very narrow range of sound down. So you can actually walk through like a spotlight
of
sound.
I've experienced that.
Yeah, wow. And it's very it's very disorienting. It's very jarring. I think one of the things I shared with you guys before the show is a sound exhibition that's on at the Science Museum in London at the moment. And that's about dark matter. And it's a collaboration between a sound artist, a theoretical physicist, and somebody who makes music using artificial intelligence.
Wow.
So they've taken dark matter simulations and they've turned them into these kind of not symphonic pieces, because they're very kind of jarring and dissonant, but they're deliberately dissonant because the concept of dark matter is quite dissonant.
It's like the Vienna School.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
Schoenberg.
It's just this way of giving people away a different way of visualizing dark matter, because dark matter is something that isn't there. It's something we can't measure. It's something that we detect because it should be there, and its absence is essentially what we detect. So this kind of installation piece is about bringing those kind of three worlds together to give you something
tangible.
That's
another form of the unseen.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I mean. It's this idea of, giving voice to something that is completely intangible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's really fascinating.
If Pauline, you had invited me to collaborate, I noticed you didn't, but anyway, what to do? If you'd invited me to collaborate, I would have said...
It would have been set in medieval...
No. I would have said, no, none of this funny business. I would have said, photographs on the wall, text underneath.
I know, you're just so
right,
old school.
Right, and people walk past and nod their heads and learn something.
You know, I saw...
I'm beaming into
at
that
an
brain.
Architecture exhibition a few weeks ago where I was speaking, there were design students who'd done this huge installation on how to live on the surface of Mars. They were the entire class was given this project to come up with the modules and the buildings and the factories and all of these things. And it was absolutely fantastic because... They were using the principles of artificial intelligence. They were using the idea of 3D printing. So they were coming up with all of these forms that didn't need Earth's gravity to exist, that would be able to exist under the very extreme solar radiation that's on the planet's surface.
Wow.
And just the creativity and the ingenuity just from these students was fantastic.
That's in Malaysia.
That was in Malaysia, yeah. That was a couple of weeks ago.
What an amazing country. Yeah? On the one hand, we've got Kuta Kepang over there.
Absolutely.
And then we got people designing life on Mars.
I actually was wondering, because Matt's thing about that artificial intelligence interpreting your brain or interpreting your thoughts. So I wonder what would happen if this artificial intelligence could, how would a Kuta Kepang dancer in trance transmit his... trance-like persona into that. Oh. I wonder how that would be interpreted.
Well, if there's a visual component to the trance, then that could effectively be live broadcast.
Because that's so interesting. Because the trance of the Kuta Kepang, they have this thing called isim. And the isim is kind of like this, it's like the totem spirit of some kind. And very often it's an animal or it's a figure. It's a physical, something with some kind of physical manifestation, at least imagined. But I wonder if you would be able to artificially recreate.
Well, it'll happen, won't it, Matt?
Yeah. In time, yes.
Yeah. Well, we must move on, though. I look forward to seeing this exhibition, which will be on in August, you said.
August 5th to 31st at the Hin Bus Depot in Penang.
Cool. And now we move, though, to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest. And Matt Armitage is going to beam it into my head right now.
Well, I am literally going to beam it in because this is the Great Hack, which is a documentary that came out on Netflix very recently. And it's all about the... Facebook data scandal, Cambridge Analytica, the British Leave EU referendum, and of course the US presidential election, Russian interference. It's very interesting. Even if you're not somebody who typically likes documentaries or is particularly into technology, the way it's filmed is fantastic. I mean, it looks absolutely phenomenal. As you're walking through the streets of New York, you can see the streams of data coming off people. They've added these effects so you can see their Facebook posts, their tweets. You can see what the marketers call data points, because the film is all about data points, the number of points of information that marketers have on every single human being. So if you're somebody who didn't really understand what the Facebook scandal was about, what Cambridge Analytica was doing with data and how it was using it to basically throw elections, this is a very easy to digest and understand kind of primer. And even for me, I know the story and I was on the edge of my seat listening to this. So that's The Great Hack on Netflix.
Cool. I'm going to check that one out. Okay, so my recommendation is obviously in keeping with the modernity that Matt Armitage just told us. And mine is, so recently I joined the Malaysian branch of the Royal Asiatic Society, mm-hmm. finally. apparently the 300 of us members.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we are the elite. And all the left behinds. And
I think it's the latter
camp. Yeah. And, but one of the books that I bought when I was there, and I can't believe I didn't have it before. I thought I had it. I thought I'd read it. I had not read it. It is J.M. Gullick's History of Kuala Lumpur. And it's just a great book.
Wow.
And J.M. Gullick he died fairly recently. He was pretty old when he died. He was originally, I think, for a short while after the war, a civil servant posted here from the army, a British guy. And then he had just had a, after that, he had a lifelong attachment to this place and to the history of this place. And he wrote many histories of Malaysia, very readable. And he's, because he's not an academic, almost a, I don't know, a kind of like a cheeky kind of style to it. And but the history of Kuala Lumpur is it's just amazing.
When was it written?
He wrote this back in the 90s. Well, it came out in the late 90s, I think. And it's just remarkable. All the characters who turned up, the different types of people who turned up, and how everybody played a role. And what a crazy, bizarre place this is.
It is, isn't it?
It really is. So my recommendation is, and I can't believe I hadn't read it before, The History of Kuala Lumpur by J.M. Gullick.
Great. Cool. Well, speaking of Kuala Lumpur, I'm going to recommend an iconic building, which has now become a wonderful venue, Rex KL, which we've all been to as Rex Cinema, has now been converted after having burnt down in two fires. And I don't know how long it was just not being in use. But a couple of young architects came together and have repurposed the place. And it's a beautiful multipurpose art space now.
Hey.
I've been in there a few times over the past few weeks. And last Saturday, so I supported them in bringing in their first secret show, which is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful series that they've just started. I think it's going to be every 6 weeks or so that they bring in a band, and it's secret. Nobody knows who it is they're bringing in, but you show up and you're pleasantly surprised.
It's like, oh my God, it's Rolling Stones. Kind of thing, are you that well connected?
Yep. Oh. Never know, Cam.
Yeah. This is Dan Chowkit, isn't it?
It's on Jalan Sultan, right in the heart of Chinatown. You know Rex KL. It's right there been there. I saw The Last Emperor there.
Rex KL.
Rex Cinema. We've all been there, and our parents have too.
All right, okay.
Our parents have all been on dates there.
I think I watched a Malcolm McDowell movie there once. Yeah. Yeah, where he got his fingers cut off.
But they've done it absolutely beautifully. So the main hall is still, it used to be a 1,000-seater cinema. And so there's that balcony space and then the main hall. And the way they've done it, it still retains that raw wall at the back, that brick wall.
So if you just turn up anyway.
If you turn up anyway, it's just a beautiful space to look at. But they actually have a lot of activities going on. So they're starting to...
They show a lot of movies and things. They have their back
lane cinema.
They've
got a little
back
lane cinema. Oh, that's
right.
Yeah. Back lane usually happens around that area. And then in the main space now they're starting to do a lot more things.
Yeah.
And one of the architects showed me, when they were like stripping the building out, he showed me there was a room that contained all the original air conditioning equipment from the 1950s. And it was this fantastic solid state, massive equipment that looked like something you'd find in the turbine gallery in the Tate Modern. Yeah. There's some really fantastic stuff in there.
Wow. Yeah.
That's incredible. See, you would love it, Cam.
Well, especially when you talk about air conditioning, you know.
I just have a thing for old machinery.
And I have a thing for air conditioning, so I can't explain it. Okay, well, I want to go. I want to go now to the Rex Cinema.
Rex KL now it's called.
Yeah, Rex KL.
Yes.
And yeah, fabulous. So that brings us to the end of this week's show. Only remains for me now to thank special honoured guest Pauline Fan.
Thank you.
And special guest Matt Armitage.
Thank you, Cam.
Thank you. And myself, Cam Raslan. And I need not tell you to like Facebook pages and everything these days, because one, we've moved on from that, and two, I'm just beaming my thoughts into your head.
Exactly.
Anyway.
We can think the lies.
Okay. So meanwhile, Old School Technology Radio, join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.